with chocolate treats mixed into dark chocolate ice cream, the Tillamook Chocolate Collection is a chocolate game changer. Because the thing that pairs best with chocolate is more chocolate. Tillamook Chocolate Collection Ice Cream. Extraordinary dairy.
Welcome to Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Vertel. Only me.
I'm Aida Osman I, the only.
Thank you. I love how Aida and I say that normally, and Louis always needs to make a scene of how he says his name.
I do believe in showmanship and zest, which we need more of these days, so I believe I'm providing a public service.
Truly.
The great showmanship, in fact.
Can I tell you something?
With Louis, it's never enough.
I have never seen that movie.
That's fair.
That doesn't shock me.
What was it? The Zac Efron or the Zendaya?
I'm interested in the idea of Rebecca Ferguson. I don't know what it is, really, but one day I might learn.
It's just pure fun. There'd be nothing for you to really dissect and have a debate about.
When people say pure fun, I think they mostly mean it's colorful and nothing else. Because it doesn't even sound fun to me. It sounds long.
Mm. Well, ketamine is pure fun and it's just white.
Okay.
So where are you drawing from experience or what is this?
Yeah, just guessing.
Ira? Are you just? Are you ketamined up?
Hmm?
The Special K?
Special K, X, crack, not Malcolm. what a wonderful episode we will have today. We're joined by a friend of mine, a friend of Lewis's, Sam Lansky.
Now a friend of mine, I hope. I love him.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you his number.
Thank you, please.
Text him whenever, honestly.
I will.
He writes books, he has a new one out, and he's also an editor at Time. I don't know how a person can do both of those things, but he manages to do that.
He's also a genius. You guys are going to hear how smart this man is. So
yes, we'll talk about his new book, Broken People. Me having him on Keep It is repayment for him taking me to San Vicente bungalows all the time.
What is that?
Yeah, what is that?
It's like the new members club restaurant in Los Angeles. It replaced Soho House.
It sounds like a gay thing. Is it a gay thing?
No, it's just like a dumb LA thing.
Okay.
Jon Favreau and his wife go.
Noted.
Bungalow is among the more sinister, but definitely gay words we have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I believe it comes from Sanskrit.
Remember Bungalow 8?
What is Bungalow 8?
Bungalow 8 sounds familiar.
The New York club that like Lindsay Lohan and those people used to go to in the early 2000s.
Oh, God.
Oh, girl.
It was always a bungalow.
Girl.
Who would she have gone with?
That was maybe like her Paris friendship time, maybe Hillary Duff pre-feud.
Mm-hmm. Now, was she a Paris Hilton Nicole Richie girl at any point?
Lindsay Lohan?
Yes.
She was a Paris girl. I assume she was friends with Nicole too. I don't remember the 2000s that much.
Stream Nikki Fresh on Quibi. Also, reminder to cancel your Quibi very soon.
Yes, yes.
If that is about to run out, girls.
If you got Quibi to watch Nikki Fresh, the show that I wrote on, or Game Show, which yes, Matt Rogers promoted on this show, your trial membership is almost up.
We just want to warn you, girl.
My calendar let me know that mine expires July 5th. I set a reminder.
That's like the last urgent reminder we have left in life. Like nothing is scheduled except for be sure to unschedule Quibi.
Yeah. Girl, I got my quick bite and now I'm leaving. I'm full. I'm done.
You're nourished.
All set.
We're also going to talk about the new HBO series, I May Destroy You, the new Netflix documentary, Disclosure, some cancellations of some very problematic men, and we also have queer hot takes this week. We'll be right back. To celebrate Pride, join us for Crooked's first and hopefully last annual at-home Pride Parade. What a long title. I know John Lovett came up with that. A live virtual event featuring a bunch of Crooked hosts and special guests to raise money for LGBTQ plus organizations, including groups on the ground right now fighting for trans lives. So please tune into Crooked Media's YouTube channel on Wednesday, June 24th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific for a 90-minute parade. Love It bought glitter, so that's worrisome. Detective reboot Perry Mason premiered on HBO this weekend, and his first case is locating HBO Max on my Roku.
He will be left wanting.
Yeah. That's just a joke. I don't have a Roku. I have an Apple TV.
You know, it's not a joke, the career of Raymond Burr. He was wonderful in Rear Window. I haven't watched the original Perry Mason, but I assume he was menacingly gay.
This is for y'all. I'm not watching no detective reboot of Perry Mason.
You know what? We're not anti-private detectives right now, Aida. I don't want to abolish the Maltese Falcon.
Right.
Okay. One can stay. One can go. Take your pick.
I actually have watched a few episodes of the original Perry Mason, but it, you know, it's not extremely my bag.
Yeah. Well, that's among the shows that I assume would be the most dated. Like, if you watch an episode of Dragnet now, there's some police issues in that show, just in general. But, like, the treating of people who drugs as sinister and disgusting. There's, like, Reefer Madness vibes to some of the cases.
Mm-hmm. I watched recently Bad Boys for Life.
Oh.
I watched it with a friend this past week, and it was, no, it's in the midst of us talking about getting rid of cop propaganda, etc. But I was like, you know what? It's the final Bad Boys installment. People have been telling me to watch it because it's enjoyable. And you know what? It kind of was. I would describe those films as the original Fast and the Furious movies. They're over the top. So this Bad Boys film was not directed by Michael I Terrorized Megan Fox Bay, which was a plus.
Oh, God.
Although he did show up in the film as the wedding MC in a little cameo.
Oh, wow. That's really crazy. Do you know what my favorite thing about Michael Bay is, who's obviously been in the news this week regarding how unfairly we've treated Megan Fox and how people don't understand that she is very sarcastically funny all the time?
Mm-hmm.
If you go to his Wikipedia, there's a giant table of the actors he's worked with multiple times, and there's dozens. They are all men.
Of course.
Except for one, Megan Fox, who fucking hates him.
Yeah.
Men like that have that habit of keeping some type of punching bag actress around them. That doesn't even shock me.
The Megan Fox thing is especially shocking for me, just because I feel like we revisit the fact that he was a piece of shit to her every 2 years.
Right.
And yet, no, like, nothing really comes of it.
And I think that's probably because we haven't had the sufficient Megan Fox second wave.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Someone like her should be playing a character like Veronica Mars, who's, like, spilling with references all the time, and mm-hmm. we trust her authority, you know, but we haven't really gotten that from her yet.
Mm-hmm. Instead, she's, I guess, going on dates with Machine Gun Kelly.
I have seen the pictures, yes.
Well, you know what? I had a moment where I was like, you know what? Y'all need to watch Beyond the Lights, because Machine Gun Kelly is actually kind of hot. And then I realized he's just tall and white.
And skinny and tattooed. He does make an appearance in the Judd Apatow film with Pete Davidson, Part-Time Adolescence. And woo!
Yeah.
I had to pause it a couple times, but then I just pressed play and remembered. No Machine Gun Kelly. Yeah. No.
Oh, but she almost had a resurgence with a Judd Apatow film as well. This is 40.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that movie just wasn't good. So, unfortunately, didn't really do anything for anyone in that film.
Yeah.
Yeah, middle-tier Apatow film, right.
Well, that might be redundant. Just a little.
The plus of Bad Boys for Life, though, is DJ Khaled. He is in it in a small scene, and he is actually fucking fantastic. It gave me that sense I had when Cardi B was in Hustlers.
Yes.
Like, someone who is sort of playing themselves, but does it with such conviction, and you really believe them on screen in that moment. And I thought that was one of the biggest surprise takeaways I got from Bad Boys for Life.
Totally a shock. And the directors, it's either Adil and Bilal, just depending, because I know they're Arabic names, mm-hmm. but are doing a good job of casting, you know, Arabic people. So it's exciting to see Middle Eastern representation, even though it's DJ Khaled. But, like, I'll take it wherever I can get it.
It's also just not a given that if you have a gregarious social media ready personality that you will be a good actor. So I'm always surprised when that works out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lewis is digging at me.
Timely, because it's been in the news lately with Chris D'Elia.
I wish I were one of those Twitter thirst buckets who would craft a story out of a minor interaction. Because when I was on You, his trailer was next to mine. And you could imagine the type of person who would be like, a log tweet thread where they said, you know, my trailer was next to Chris D'Elia's. And I just had this sense. I knew that he was creepy. I felt the foreboding.
I'm mad. I'm so pissed at you for this because probably somewhere in my drafts right now is a story of me meeting Chris D'Elia at the Comedy Store and how grimy I felt like he was. So I'm the thirst bucket. The thirst bucket is I.
I never really had a sense, obviously, that he was grimy in the way that he was preying on underage girls. I just thought that he was unfunny.
He's unfunny and certainly off. Certainly off.
Yeah. And as much as Lewis and I may enjoy Whitney Cummings, I always resented her for foisting him on us with the sitcom Whitney.
100%.
Because going back and watching that show, he just sticks out like a sore thumb in it. I'm like, why is he here?
Though, justice for Malik Pancholi, who was on that show and who played Jonathan, the assistant on 30 Rock.
Oh, yeah.
I always thought he was so funny. And weirdly, on 30 Rock, they like lost track of that character and didn't figure out like how to keep making him funny. Like his crush on Jack became too pronounced. But then Malik Pancholi moved to Whitney. And then I haven't seen much of him lately. And he's an out gay actor. So
honestly, bring Whitney back. That was one of my favorite shows that like really inspired me that women could be in comedy and, you know, be allowed the space to have their own television show and do whatever they wanted with it.
Honestly, reboot Whitney and open it by finding out that Chris D'Elia's character died in a horrible car accident.
Yes.
Or went to prison.
Let's text her. We can start the room this week.
Yeah. Have him go to prison for what Chris has apparently done IRL and let that be the show.
My favorite clip that's circulating right now is Chris D'Elia having done a podcast with some of his friends, and they tell him that Snapchat is actually, there's a feature where you can like screenshot or save the messages, and his face just drops to his ankles. Like he's so floored, and you can see him losing his fucking mind in the clip.
I almost wanted to see him in that clip be assured that if someone takes a screenshot, you get a notification of it, just to see him like to confirm, yes, that he was waiting for that relief, but we didn't get that.
He's in trouble.
This is why straight men are dumb. There is not a single faggot who does not know that Snapchat stories can be saved and downloaded, okay? If you send a dick pic through Snapchat, somebody has that in their camera roll.
The whole world is seeing it. You might as well have plastered it on the front page of the New York Times.
This is, of course, from the news that Chris, who played a pedophile in You, the show that I was in, and also an episode of Workaholics.
Yes, and another, old Comedy Central
show. A real method actor is now accused of being one in real life. A woman named Simone Rossi opened the floodgates by tweeting, "I still can't believe Netflix cast Chris D'Elia as the pedophile in You, like the literal irony." And since then, many women have alleged that he solicited illicit photos from them as teenagers or behaved inappropriately, such as requesting cuddles, making out, or joining him in a hotel room.
Yuck. Requesting cuddles. Yuck.
Requesting cuddles. That is some of the grossest part to me. Because I specifically have an ex like hookup in West Hollywood who his thing is like cuddling, and sometimes he'll text me like,
"Okay, girl,
hey, do you want to cuddle?" And I'm like, that is truly the creepiest text I've ever gotten.
I am grown. I'm grown.
I don't know if Merriam-Webster, who's responsible for that word, but we did a bad job coming up with the word cuddle. Like, syllabically, I don't want to say it.
Totally.
But also,
it's too close to curdle.
Yeah, exactly. Too close precisely. To curdle. And also, if talking about this guy who requests them, like, we have words like spoon and stuff. Like, think about how it's hitting my ear. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Well, he knows. If he wants a younger girl, cuddle is probably the appropriate word. Mm. That's disgusting. Ugh.
It's a horrible story.
Well, and also the thing about Chris D'Elia, though, is that he's been a person that I guess people just generally haven't liked anyway, which is why it was easy to get him up out of the paint this week, as opposed to, say, Ansel Elgort.
Yeah, that's been pulling teeth.
Well, because on Friday, a Twitter user identified as Gabby posted a statement accusing Elgort of sexually assaulting her in 2014. She tweeted a lengthy statement describing the assault, beginning by explaining that she was only 17 years old at the time. And he responded that he was a dick, but in an entirely legal way. And that thing has sort of gone away. Which, to be honest, unfortunately, that's pretty much what I expected. Just because it reminds me a lot of the Aziz Ansari story. Yes?
Yeah.
And it is a conversation to be had about men being creepy when we're having sex. But so much of the story about repeating that she was 17, highlighting these things. Unfortunately, if it had come through like a publicist or, you know, like a journalist, you know, reporting this to really sort of like stick the story landing, I could see it going somewhere further. But something like this, especially when it was at the age of consent at that time in the state, is going to be harder in a climate like this to stick something, particularly when Ansel Elgort, unfortunately, isn't a person who has a history of people hating him the way Chris D'Elia does, right?
Was it you who suggested there should be a remake of Baby Driver, though?
Yes. Well, so apparently John Boyega had initially been up for the role in Baby Driver, and I was like, replace Ansel with John Boyega and then cast Denzel Washington in the Kevin Spacey role. And just reshoot it. Because the film, which I adore, by the way, I do really love Baby Driver, is set in Atlanta. It's a very white film to be set in Atlanta. And there's also a relationship that Ansel's character, Baby, has with a blind older black man.
Right.
That seems a little white savory.
Yeah.
And a black character playing that role would be much nicer. Mm-hmm. Also, that relationship and then the relationship with John Boyega and the Kevin Spacey character would sort of say a lot about black patriarchy and fathers and sons in a way that would probably improve the movie as well.
My problem with that movie is I do believe there is a darkness to John Hamm, and I do think it should be explored, and I want to see it in the capacity of villains, but I didn't believe him as that villain for some reason. Mm-hmm. And I felt like maybe, I think I was surprised that he ended up being the main villain at the end, because he sort of just seemed like a henchman, and that felt more appropriate. So that escalation felt strange to me or something.
That's one of those films that, because of tax credits and things, like, will shoot in a city like Atlanta, and then it ends up looking dumb when the film is majority white people, unfortunately.
That movie has some slick editing, though. That's very memorable editing for a movie.
Yes, I mean, that's a signature of Edgar Wright films, though. You know, he's a very slick sort of pop culture-oriented director. And the music really propels Baby Driver, I would say.
I would just say, not my friends texting me Ansel Elgort is actually Baby Lover. I was so mad. I am happy, though. I know, bye. I am happy, though, that, like, you know, women are finally having, we were clearly living in, like, a pressure cooker, and all this information was just simmering until it could come out. And, you know, it's timely and perfect that we had Drew Dixon on the other day, because I feel like, you know, her story, her documentary, everything has kind of emboldened women to come out and be inspired by other people. So let's go.
Yeah.
Justin Bieber fallen, Danny Masterson, Jeff Ross, let's go. Let it all burn down. Start Hollywood over.
In light of these, one of the things that I've been watching this past weekend is the new Michaela Cole show, I May Destroy You, on HBO. And that is one of my favorite things I've seen recently.
You have to explain this thing to me, because everybody's obsessed with it and I haven't seen it yet.
So Michaela Cole plays Arabella. She's a writer who has some sort of internet fame, and she's trying to work on her next piece, and has some writer's block and goes to Italy for a few months, I guess, to work on it. But the series starts with her returning to London. The night before the piece is due, she goes out with a friend and is roofied and raped. And it's about her trying to piece together what happened to her that night and the other people in her life also dealing with a man that's cheating on you and that sort of sexual intimacy becoming a lie. And then there's a really amazing third episode that's in Italy where her best friend Terry also deals with consent. Like, the show blends genres, you know, like she's regular Rod Serling in it. But it also keeps coming back to the idea of sexual relationships and intimacy and consent. And it is just such a beautiful, beautiful show. And it jumps from this serious shit to becoming such a hilarious comedy to then like mystery elements. I love it. I love it. And Michaela Cole is so fucking smart.
Oh.
And I'm glad that we're talking about this series so much, because when everyone was having their Fleabag moment, I was like, we need to be talking about Michaela Cole.
Thank you. Thank you. And as much as I love Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and I will never dismiss her from this conversation, Michaela Cole writing the show, it's easily one of the best pieces of television for me and hopefully for everyone else. It's the first real, honest depiction of what it looks like to be a black woman who's assaulted. And then you get to watch Michaela's character, Arabella, go between denying it, accepting it, learning to fight against it, learning to accept it as well. And it's dizzying, it's harrowing, but it's hilarious and beautiful. And HBO Max, once again, that girl and a half.
I would also say that for people who are worried about it being sort of triggering to watch, I think that it's handled deftly. It isn't salacious to the point of making you just sort of relive this rape in a gross way. You don't see it viscerally the way that you would expect it.
Yeah.
It wasn't triggering to me as a person who has been drugged at a bar before. So I would say that it is a show that you can watch, and Michaela Cole sort of really has her audience in mind when she's watching it. Obviously, it's not about a situation like mine. It's about a black woman. But she has her audience in mind, and you can tell that there's care taken to not just traumatize people with this story. And it's having an important conversation, but she's also telling a story and being fucking funny, and there's great acting in it, and it says so much about black female friendships. And it's also weirdly a very funny series that is about a writer, and her best friend is an actor. And I think that, like, setting it in London and not in Hollywood, you're able to tell this story in a more interesting, universal way.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Watch it. Make sure you watch it. It's a good show, isn't it? It's a good show.
Good show, isn't it?
And you get to pretend that you have a bunch of black friends and you're partying in London too. So there's some enjoyment there, even though they're grimy.
So, speaking of harrowing yet important, can we talk about Disclosure for a second? The new Netflix documentary about trans representation and Hollywood history and how images of trans people have, by the way, been around since the beginning of film, including D.W. Griffith himself getting into the mix. Let me tell you something. He does not handle it well. I've got news for you.
really? Because I thought he handled blackface so well.
I know, right. The master, D.W. Griffith. Yes. This is a documentary that's a lot like The Celluloid Closet, if you've ever seen it, where they go through all these old images that seem so crazy now, so inflammatory. And yet, the other thing that's crazy is, as long as there have been trans images, those images have not been for the consumption of trans people. Mm-hmm. No movie director in, like, whatever, the 30s, let alone, or the 80s, whatever, put these images in their films thinking, oh, other trans people will absorb these, or even that trans people even really exist. Mm-hmm. It's basically a real fast 101 swift study of how conditioned we were to dehumanize trans people. And the talking heads are so brilliant constantly. Like, we already know Laverne Cox can pop off with a TED Talk whenever she wants. But everybody in this movie, Jen Richards, who's a trans actress, who, like,
Jen Richards. And she's so smart.
Yes.
The way she talks about I Am Kate as a series, they're very smart to sidestep dragging Caitlyn Jenner, who is trash on the record. the way they sidestep it, though, because they want to talk about the importance of how I Am Kate just allowed trans people to have real conversations on television,
right,
that they had not gotten to have in any sort of other like reality series. So they'll always be grateful to, you know, the Kardashians and Caitlyn for facilitating this.
Right. And also, I mean, like Candace Kane, trans actress, talks about when she was on the show Dirty Sexy Money, and in her first scene, to indicate that she was trans, the show lowered her voice 2 octaves so that the audience mm-hmm. would understand it. Just like simple things like that mm-hmm. that would mm-hmm. never be revisited again are like given a spotlight here.
And only in the first episode.
Correct.
Her first line of dialogue, they lower her octave and then they keep her voice the same the rest of the episode. And that is something, as a fan of that show, never even registered to me, obviously, watching this show in like high school.
Right. And also, that show starred the unproblematic Baldwin, Billy Baldwin.
I love Billy.
They go through things like salacious episodes of Jerry Springer where, you know, people basically attack trans people on television. Mm-hmm. You know, it goes through all sorts of versions of representation, and it's just incredible to watch. Your parents should watch it. It's so brilliantly laid out, and people are so smart about their own experience and how watching, you know, Silence of the Lambs affected them growing up as a trans person. Just watch it. It's great.
That's what I would say. It was a documentary that felt infuriating, but also galvanizing as a queer creator to just want to learn more about trans stories and help trans people better tell their stories. You know, I think that we talk about how to be allies. And, you know, while we are all three of us also marginalized people trying to make it in Hollywood. And I'll talk about that a bit more later in my Keep It. It is important to also recognize that we have more privilege in a way than trans people do, you know? And the Jerry Springer sort of thing was really interesting to me too, just because I have long contended that the daytime talk show era was so important, despite how gross and racy and exploitative it was, just because they talk in the documentary, so many people, about seeing those images on TV. That was the first time they were seeing like black trans men, you know, or trans women sort of owning themselves. And I think it was Trace Lissette or Jen Richards just talking about the fact that these trans women of the time were being exploited, but also because of the way that capitalism is set up and discrimination against trans people, they were also able to collect a check from these talk shows, right? Yeah. So like going on a show and being a sideshow is paying your bills and keeping you fed and keeping you from having to do sex work or anything else dangerous as a trans person when you're on the marginalized sides of society. And I just remember that, you know, as a gay person, you know, like we would see gay people on these talk shows, right?
Right, yeah.
And it's just weird to go back and see them now and say, oh yeah, those are crazy, but also they're real people. And that was the first time we would have a sight about that.
Right. What other opportunity did we have to see just gay people living, you know? We pretend like everybody was watching The Real World at the time. It's like, mm-hmm. if I'm 11 years old, maybe I don't even know how to get to MTV. Meanwhile, right. what's on after The Price is Right, one of these shows, you know?
Millions of people watching these shows. Mm-hmm. And just speaking about queer people being out there and representing themselves, I know Lewis and I would be remiss to not mention the passing of Joel Schumacher.
Oh, God.
On Monday, a fantastic director, I would say, who is basically should have his own book that is an addendum to Susan Sontag's Notes on Camp.
Oh, sure.
Because he is a director who we've mentioned before. He's an out gay director who was directing mainstream films at like Flatliners, Lost Boys, Batman and Robin, Batman Forever, and
was he out at the time?
Yes.
Just for context for me. So he was out of the. So when he put nipples on Batman, he was a gay man.
Yes. People in Hollywood knew that he was gay. You know?
Wonderful, wonderful.
And it's just really fun going back and revisiting these movies, which were campy and over the top.
Mm-hmm.
And just realizing how much of that was a gay man putting up queer themes into mainstream films.
Yeah, intentionally having fun. So much of like the discourse about Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. Like I just remember, I have 3 straight brothers. I remember them watching, or my older brother Jim watching the movie at the time and being like, ugh. And like, but not having enough context to be like, or giving me enough context to be like, this is a campy movie really meant to make you fucking laugh a lot. You know,
yeah.
It is not a serious movie. I actually rewatched Joel Schumacher's The Client yesterday, which is, you gave us Susan Sarandon as a hard-bitten former alcoholic lawyer.
Yes.
Good performance to rewatch. I also rewatched St. Elmo's Fire, which is dreadful.
Yes.
But
it's yeah. awful. It's awful.
But gave us Demi Moore. So.
I will
yes,
say.
Yes. And Mayor Winningham. Mayor Winningham. Yes.
Yes.
I will say the pure faggotry of that movie's theme song, though.
Oh,
and how it just blows up in every scene. And who is I've seen that movie like twice, and it really is abysmal. Who is in the scene where they're basically just sitting in a bedroom and wind is blowing through curtains dramatically, and it looks like it's Suspiria?
Oh yeah, Demi Moore is definitely sitting shivering during one of her benders in the movie. That movie is signature Brat Pack, and that it gives you childish men who are angry constantly for no reason and women looking offended with tears in their eyes. That's what we got from Brat Pack movies.
Yeah. It definitely is interesting to see the conversation between the Batman films, you know, the way that straight men have really tried to reclaim them with the Chris Nolan films.
Right.
Chris Nolan, meanwhile, who's trying to kill us all by forcing theaters to reopen so people will go see Tenet in July. Sorry you want us to die for your film, Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, right.
But they want to reclaim Batman just because those 90s films are just so much for gays.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Like Batman Returns is basically like an opus of Michelle Pfeiffer's, and there's nothing gayer than Selena Kyle's transformation in that film. And then you have Joel Schumacher's films, Batman Forever, with Nicole Kidman in it as Dr. Chase Meridian, and Batman and Robin, with everything that Alicia Silverstone and Uma Thurman do in this film. Even Mr. Freeze is so gay in that film. You know, like with the blue paint walking around in this fur coat. Vivica Fox, misbehaving.
Right. No, my favorite thing in Batman and Robin is Alicia Silverstone having to hack into a computer and finding the password to the right of the screen. That's my favorite thing. She's like, peg. Yeah.
Truly, whatever he was able to do to channel a gay man into Uma Thurman in Poison Ivy in Batman and Robin deserves to be in the film canon forever. You know, a film that gave us the classic line, as I told Lady Freeze when I pulled her plug, this is
a one-woman
show. As forever. She's fighting with Alicia Silverstone, and then as Poison Ivy takes a dagger and looks at her reflection.
Correct.
In it. Like, and the opening, which is the ode to Marlene Dietrich.
Right, right. Right.
Another queer icon. There's just so much in Joel Schumacher's films that you need to analyze. Even just down to making vampires sexy in Lost Boys and the sexuality of having men like Kiefer Sutherland strapped to a table naked in flatliners.
Oh, yeah. Also,
also making me sexually attracted to men in masks.
Yes.
Phantom of the Opera of it.
Yes.
Oof. Oh, which reminds me, of course, of that story that Minnie Driver told, where she was talking about an on-set story, Phantom of the Opera, where another actress, whom she didn't name, I can only assume it's Emmy Rossum, I can't imagine it's Miranda Richardson, said that Minnie Driver was being over the top, and Joel Schumacher responded, "Oh, honey, nobody ever paid to see Under the Top." Legend.
Legend, and I think we talked about this when Bowen was on. He reportedly said that he has fucked over 20,000 men in his lifetime. So
Joel said that?
Yes.
Yes.
So, you know what? He said it in his Vulture profile. So go and read that profile. RIP to a legend.
That's the level of gayness I expect from somebody who casts Drew Barrymore and Debbie Mazar as people named Sugar and Spice.
Yes. So RIP to a gay icon. We'll be right back with Sam Lansky. We'll be right back. Keep It is brought to you by Barefoot Dreams. Lewis?
Yes?
When you see footprints in the sand, that was when I carried you in my Barefoot Dreams robe.
Now, is that a Leona Lewis song? No?
If you want to bring coziness into your life, you turn to Barefoot Dreams, especially now as the brand is celebrating their 30th anniversary. With those 30 years of coziness, Barefoot Dreams celebrates being the originators of everyone's favorite luxe home blanket. And while many have attempted to duplicate their blankets, robes, and more, Barefoot Dreams' fabrication and quality cannot be replicated, so don't believe the dupes. Girl, this blanket is it.
I effing love this blanket. I'm thinking about it right now, and I want to jump in my bed, which is sponsored by something that we'll do another ad for momentarily. Get ready. There's a reason why Barefoot Dreams has been on Oprah's favorite things list 6 times. Jesus, get a life, Oprah. My God. Dressing head to toe in Barefoot Dreams is the key to comfort, as their collection of ultra-soft robes, loungewear, and accessories are made with premium materials. Their products make the perfect gifts, too. I throw this thing on. I wear it like a shawl. I look exactly like Ellen Burstyn. And I am the coziest a human being can be. Because, by the way, it's still that time in Los Angeles where it's like pretty mild outside and then your apartment is cold. I can't explain it. I don't know things like basic science. For Keep It listeners, you can get 15% off your first purchase at barefootdreams.com with the code KEEPIT15. Don't miss out on Barefoot Dreams' soft, soothing fabrics that will bring luxury to your life.
In our guest's new book, a globetrotting shaman apparently has the ability to fix everything that's wrong with you in just 3 days. And the protagonist, Sam, is interested in the offer. Please welcome the author of Broken People, Sam Lansky.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm honored. I'm delighted. I'm humbled. It's very nice to see you all.
Well, your first book came out pre-Keep It. So
I know. I didn't have the chance to make this the most vital stop on my promo cycle on my tour. And now we get to make up for all the lost time. I love it.
Sam, The Gilded Razor is to me a book that would be incredibly harrowing to write.
You
reconcile with much of a very difficult, almost insurmountably self-destructive streak. How did you even think to write a second book after that? Did you know you had it in you to write a second book?
Can I be honest? I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know why I'm like this. I keep asking myself why I'm like this, why I keep doing this. And yes, I don't think I have answers for you. I don't know. It's a weird thing. I mean, my first book was, which came out in 2016, was a memoir about my teenage years just being like an absolute terror twink. That's a term that I've patented. Just running amok all over New York City, causing all kinds of mayhem and chaos and dysfunction for myself and the people around me. And when I came out of that, I was like, I think I'm done. Like, what's the, you know, that's enough, whatever for the day meme. Like, that was me with like, that's enough books for today. like I am done with books. And then this story just kind of came to me, and it was inspired by experiences that I had had. And kind of things that I had walked through, primarily the experience of moving to LA from New York, which I was actually the first person in history to do. It was kind of a historic moment, I think, for me and for the community when I bravely moved to LA from New York and then wrote about it. But I had this experience of moving to LA and feeling like the culture of like new age stuff and mysticism and wellness was so different here. And I had this moment like maybe 6 months after I moved to LA where everyone had been talking about how the energy was weird. Like, I don't know if Mercury was in retrograde or like what was going on, but people just keep talking about how like the energy was strange in LA. And I had this moment where like I got home from a long day and was like, is energy real? Like, is there like if I like
Carrie Hilson says so.
That's right. Yes.
That is absolutely right, Ira. And I'm glad you're bringing Carrie into this conversation. But I realized I no longer knew after 6 months in LA whether energy, the way people talked about it, was like a verifiable scientific thing that you could like look at, or if it was just like a kind of made up thing that people kept talking about at Cafe Gratitude. So I, anyway, energy is real insofar as there's like calories and joules, but like energy in terms of like the energy beings, there is no scientific basis for that. But those are the kinds of questions where I was like, am I losing my mind living here? And a lot of that is sort of what I poured into this book, which is kind of like an interrogation of all of that stuff. What does it mean to be well? What does it mean to be well in a world where people are constantly trying to tell you that there's something wrong with you so they can sell you snake oil? And like, how do we navigate that and negotiate that?
When I started reading it, I was shocked because at first I was like, now I know this bitch told me he wrote a novel.
I did.
I know. But I was starting it and I was like, did Sam write another memoir? Because the main character's name is Sam. And he has written a memoir before about addiction. What sort of inspired you to take your story and make it into a novel and sort of closely hew to things that had happened to you?
I just have so much imagination, Ira. I'm just like such a like George R. R. Martin kind of, like I don't know where I come up with this stuff. No, I had become really curious in my own writing about the stories that we tell ourselves about who we think we are and what we are doing in the world. And as someone who had literally like commercialized my own story, who had like written a memoir and like, you know, promoted the memoir and people had read the memoir and like had spent all this time writing a story about myself, I was really curious, like, what does it mean when we do that? And the ways in which we all do that, like the ways in which we do that on Instagram, the ways in which we do that just as we kind of move through the world, how that tendency to self-narrativize like can be a really great and helpful thing, and also how it can be a thing that can keep us really stuck in like these made up stories that we've told ourselves about who we are and how difficult it can be to break out of that. I wanted to write about that, and I wanted the funhouse mirror effect of like writing about what in many ways is a kind of alternate reality version of myself, who is also, who is a guy named Sam, who is a writer, who is reckoning with like, what does it mean when you tell a story about yourself, to the people around you? And how can that be a really freeing thing? And how can that be something that keeps us down effectively? So that's part of why I did it. I am happy to share that the New York Times described the book as a memoir in drag, which I which I think was like a little bit of a an elbow, but like I really loved it. Like I was fucking delighted by that, honestly, because that's very much like, to the extent that that now I'm mortified that everyone knows I like read my own press, which like truly let me just like walk into the ocean.
You're so sweet. It's like you're interviewing me. I was gonna ask you, I mean, even though we're talking about this is a fictionalized version of you, and I know that when an author writes a book, they probably discover more and more about themselves through this character. How did that experience go? What were you unpacking while you were writing Sam and being another Sam at the same time?
A lot. A lot. God, there were so many things. I don't know where to begin. For a long time, until I was smartly convinced otherwise by literally everyone, I wanted to call the book Gay Mistakes. Like that was my working title as I was writing. Because I was thinking about
good, now I can use it.
Yeah, no, please run with it. It's yours now. I thought about how many like idiosyncratically and specifically gay mistakes I made in my 20s, like in relationships, in my career, in all of these spaces in my life, in my relationship with myself, just how many things I had spectacularly fucked up that felt kind of like specific to my experience of being gay and being gay in the world. And like, I feel like I spent a lot of my 20s really attached to like status markers and feeling like, you know, if I behaved a certain way or if people perceived me a certain way, then like I would have value. And that was something that I unpacked and interrogated a lot as I was writing the book, my relationship to or my attachment to all of the things that I thought made people see me a certain way and why I thought all of that was so important. And then I think, you know, this idea of self-narrativizing, like, you know, at the risk of getting like extremely velvet rage, like, you know, in trusting that this is a safe space, like I had a lot of stuff about like not being enough that I was continuing to carry, like not feeling like enough, which I think so many of us have, and we process that in different ways, right? Like some of us overcompensate, some of us sort of undercompensate. Some of us are ego-driven from that place of like really having something to prove. Some of us are self-effacing. And I feel like I was all of those at once. And so part of what I had to figure out was like, how do I change that story? How do I heal those parts of myself? Which sounds very like new age, witchy. Like I often feel like I am like West Hollywood's budget Marianne Williamson when I talk about this stuff.
Marianne Williamson should be budget to begin with.
She's budget you. How about that?
Oh my God, thank you. That is really kind of you to say. I don't know if I would go that far, but I'll take it.
I would say so many things that are in your book that are like new agey things, literally flashing back being like, you know what? I first heard about these things from Sam.
Oh, really? Oh, good. Yes. Okay. I'm glad to be an evangelist of like insane LA wellness culture. That's all I have ever wanted to be. I learned a lot about my own tendencies to like spin those stories about myself, and then also how it is like possible to break out of those. And I feel like that was the big takeaway from writing the book.
It's not even new agey, I would say. One thing I really liked about the book was this line towards the end. Sam is talking with his ex-boyfriend, Charles, and he mentions, you know, that he turned the people in his life into characters. He'd pick the narrative, then fit people in his experience of them to reinforce it. And that doesn't even feel new agey. That feels like shit I've been talking about with my new therapist that I got in quarantine.
How is the new therapist going? And, I want to hear about
them.
That.
Okay. I love them. Okay, I love them. But it's this idea. What I really loved about it too was it felt as gay men, you know, the book was about body image issues, but it was also about relationships. And I was talking with a friend of mine the other night and a therapist about this, you know, like this idea that you meet people in your life. And I think it really touched on sometimes you have relationships with people that you date. And you're sort of like, why didn't this work out? Or you're thinking that this is the person that you're going to marry. And then you realize sort of later that you met them and they had one aspect that was really great for you. But then you shaded in that aspect in every other moment that you were with them to make it fit this narrative that you had, you know, and like on a base level, that is like, if you think a guy is really funny because like he makes you laugh once, like every other time you're interacting with him, you're like, ooh, he's the funniest person ever. And then when you break up with him, your friends will be like, girl, he was not funny. You know?
Yeah.
So I really loved how the book like touched on like sort of lies we tell ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a perfect articulation of it. We do tell ourselves these lies, and like at the risk of being overly cute, I think a lot of people were like, why is this a novel when this is like in so many ways clearly about you or a sort of version of you? And like the whole point of doing it as a work of fiction is that every story we tell ourselves is a work of fiction, yeah. Right? Like every, the very act of being like, this is who I am and putting that out in the world, whether it's in your Instagram story or in a book strangers are reading, like is this act of creation of a work of fiction. And we do that to other people too, I think, or at least I do. Maybe that's just because I'm a lunatic, but I feel like so many of my relationships and experiences were about, okay, how can this person reinforce what I already believe about myself or what I already kind of think to be true about myself? And the work, I think, is in like actually seeing people for what they are. And you can do that in retrospect, usually. You can look back on that relationship and be like, oh, that guy was not that dope. Like, he was not actually funny. But it usually takes a minute. And like, part of what I'm trying to get better at, what I'm talking about with my new core therapist, who I love, is, and we'll be talking to later today, the, you know, how do I like close that gap between me doing the same like stupid shit that I always do in my relationships and in my life? And like, how can I get to where I'm realizing like, a week later that I did that again, as opposed to like 6 months later or when I am writing the next book. Like, how can I like, you know, close that space so I become a little bit more aware of my own patterns?
After all this time, are there parts of yourself that you find surprisingly difficult to write about or talk about? I would think almost at this point you have it down to a science, but like I'm sure that can't be the case. Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's down to a science. I actually just the other night I was looking through like some of the stuff that I kind of wrote along the way to writing this book, and I had so much resistance to writing certain parts of the story and to talking about certain parts of the story. Like, I, you know, had always really struggled with body image stuff. And that was just something that I had a really hard time talking about for a long time. There's a line in the book where Sam says something to the effect of like, it was as if by not talking about his body, people would not notice that he had one. And that was always how I felt. Like, I always felt like, okay, if I just don't address the fact that I have a body or what size it is, everyone will pretend like it just doesn't exist, you know, and I'm just like a disembodied soul, and I will not have to deal with the fact that I'm like in this weird skin suit all the time. And that was something that I had so much discomfort about that I knew it was important for me as a writer in my process. And I'm sure you've all worked through this too in your own, you know, writing and you know, comedy and everything else. Like, anything that feels sticky is probably going to be interesting. There were so many things that I felt and thought while writing this book where I was like, cool, I'm the first person in human history to have felt this way, like to have had this specific feeling. And like, always those are the universal feelings, you know, always those are the feelings that I think people respond to in the deepest way, is the thing that feels so like specific and embarrassing that you could never ever say it out loud. I felt like there were like tripwires all over this book. I mean, I was writing about the body image stuff. I was writing about sort of mysticism through this new lens. I really wanted to write about PrEP and sort of like the way that's changed how gay men approach intimacy with one another. And that's a big theme of the book too. All of that just felt like I'm totally fucking out of my depth writing about this. But I just had to kind of like forge through and hope for the best, because they were all things that I felt like were really kind of important to say.
And it's good that you brought up the specificity stuff. That's actually what I was going to ask you. I mean, I know that all of us as queer writers have this, again, sticky situation where we have esoteric stories and we have these very specific ideas about the world. When do you recognize that when you're writing and go, maybe I should hide some things so more people can understand what I'm trying to say? Or do you just write as honestly as possible and hope that that gets your message across?
I have learned that the more specific the experience, the more universal the feeling. And I think that's just like a general rule of thumb for me as a writer and as a person who made a career out of over-disclosing and like sharing extremely personal parts of myself, that like, the deeper I go into something that feels totally, totally specific, the better what I'm sharing will resonate deeply. I had this experience with writing my first book where, like, you know, I was such a nightmare as a teenager. And when I wrote that book and sold that book when I was still, you know, pretty young in my mid-20s, I was like, oh, they're letting me do this because my story is so batshit, because my boyfriend when I was 17 was 43 and I was like, you know, running all over Manhattan, like just kind of creating so much chaos. Like, the singular weirdness of my story is the only reason I'm being given this platform. And then the book came out and I heard from all of these people who were like, I connected to this so much. Like, I related to this. Like, you have told my story. And I was like, I don't think so, because I thought the whole point of this was that my story was really distinct and special and unique. And that was really like humbling and kind of, you know, ego reducing for me to realize that by digging in and not shying away from the specifics, I had actually made people feel kind of seen or understood. In a way that I didn't know was going to happen. Like, I thought I was writing this like freak show story of my own madness, and actually people found it really relatable. And that was a good like capsule lesson for me in the importance of continuing to do that.
Do you find it hard as a writer to go back to the careers that like we've had, you know, before writing? You know, you're still, you know, West Coast editor at Time. Do you find it weird to like still be jumping back and forth between these things?
It's funny to wear both hats of being both the sort of like interviewer, reporter, like, you know, person who's ceding space to make room for somebody else, which is so much of what I'm done in my career. And then to suddenly be like, quote unquote, talent. I don't have a better word for it.
The glistening in your eye when talent was said. I will remember it. Yeah.
I'm sure that was haunting. I'm so sorry. But you know, suddenly like you become the subject after having not been for a really long time. And that cycle of moving into like, now I am the person who the kind of spotlight is on is just like weird and disorienting. I feel really, really lucky to have a job, a career where I have this kind of flexibility and where I get to do, you know, really cool stuff and like work on, you know, big projects and work on cover stories and do all of that. Like that's super gratifying for me. I'm more aware of the like sudden shift from being like, you know, the guy who's just sort of like on emails and like, you know, hunched over my desk and then I'm like out in the world doing stuff like this. And I'm kind of like, holy shit, I wasn't prepared for that after a long period of like, of sort of visible dormancy.
Do you have a favorite Time cover story that you've worked on? I mean, like Time now, when I think of, they have annual issues that are always so exciting, et cetera. And they seem like intense undertakings. There will sometimes be 100 contributors, most of them celebrities.
Yes.
Do you have particular issues that you are fond of?
I definitely have issues that I'm fond of. I'm trying to think of like the ones of which I am most proud. We do the Time 100 every year, and which is our list of the 100 most influential people in the world. I contribute to that issue, and putting those together year after year is like one of the great joys of my life. Because the whole idea is that you have celebrities writing about, you know, other people, like every contributor is a boldface name. So I come up with these pairings, you know, alongside a lot of other really smart people. And then we like go see if we can make it happen. And the like behind the scenes wheeling and dealing of that is really fun. And the finding out who actually likes who is really fun when you like repeatedly go to people and, you know, who you think are like, our friends are aligned and they pass and they don't actually want to do it. Write about the person that they're sort of like doing a performance of friendship with wherever, like that kind of thing is really fun. I think that's like my favorite part is like the pulling back of the veil where I'm suddenly like, oh, okay. I didn't know that. All right. And then getting to like, you know, pair those voices together. I mean, like there are just so many that have been so wild that we've been able to put together. I had Adele write about Rihanna a couple of years ago, and that's just like, you know, I mean, like that's like the dream. That is everything you want. And she could not have been more excited to do it, and she could not have been more. And it's like it's a beautiful write up. You know, it's just like it's a perfect tribute from one legend to another. So like getting to have fingerprints on stuff like that is crazy and the coolest.
I love that. You know, can't wait for you to reach out to Lewis to write about me.
You think that's what's going to happen?
I'm very excited for that. Yeah,
he'll write a ransom note and say,
"I have
Ira."
It will be written in giant magazine letters for one thing. Yeah, help me. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here, Sam.
Thank you so much for having
me.
I'm so honored.
I'm so happy for you.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I'm thrilled to have this opportunity to speak with you.
I'm Roman Mars, host of 99% Invisible. I love the book, The Power Broker, the epic biography of former New York City planner Robert Moses. So I'm breaking it down 100 pages at a time and talking to special guests about why this book matters, like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I actually think if it wasn't for Robert Moses, I probably wouldn't have run for Congress.
Listen to 99% Invisible's breakdown of The Power Broker every month on the 99% Invisible podcast feed.
And we're back with one of our favorite new segments of quarantine. We're doing hot takes again.
It turns out other people have opinions. It's not just the three of us. And I am both relieved and a little worried that other people could contain this much rage and then express it.
This time, we're not doing pop culture hot takes. We're doing specifically queer pop culture hot takes.
So they should be extra piquant.
And we are going to have our own opinions on these takes.
I'm prepared to be mad about them. I have a fly swatter ready to swat at the bad hot takes, so we'll see how it goes.
Nice. I mean, I'm just naturally contrarian and I love fighting, so let's see what happens.
Done.
All right.
Hi, Ira, Aida, and Lewis. My name's Dominic from New Hampshire. My queer hot take is that killing Caesar is the gayest thing that has ever been done. So these people, they leave the city of Rome to have this, like, ceremony, and they've been secretly plotting to kill Caesar for months. Talk about a stunt. And they walk into the room, they distract Mark Antony. How camp. And they go, "Sic semper tyrannis!" And Caesar, who, like, is, like, the epitome of camp, he's all about spectacle and, like, just, like, I'm gonna wear these things that are totally taboo and, like, I'm gonna be like, "Oh, king, who?" Amazing. And so they say, "Semper Tyrannis, bitch," and then they kill him and stab him a bunch of times, and his reply isn't like, "Ow," it's nothing. He looks at his friend Brutus and just goes, "Et tu, Brutai?" He's like, "Even you? Like, you know they were dating. Come on, you know there was something more than that. They were friends with Benny's, at least." Anyway, though it was the gay, and it created, like, the gayest, like, civilization of all time, because, like, what's gayer than a gladiator match? Nothing. So that was pretty gay, pretty queer. And despite all of that, it was a mistake. Our boy Caesar deserved to live, I think. All right. Thanks, guys.
When he said the words "killing Caesar," I, for a second, thought there was a Bill O'Reilly book I didn't know about. But secondly... Yeah.
Or like, Phoebe Waller-Bridge spinoff of Killing Eve.
Right,
I really
yes.
didn't know.
Is there a character? Yeah, does Villanelle have a brother I don't know about, etc.? Yes. Yeah, if you're going to be killed in an ambush in Rome and yet you still have a witticism about you, I have to respect what can only be described as queerness there. That's what that is.
Truly, it jumps out.
I would say that the killing of Caesar is not necessarily the gayest thing ever. And I would actually say that that's pretty mundane and straight. It's a bunch of senators. I will say that a real queer event in history was modeled after it, and in turning the killing of Caesar into camp, that is where we got our gayest historical moment, and that is John Wilkes Booth killing Lincoln.
Okay, to add to that, I do agree with you. I would argue anything premeditated is gay, just off top. I think I would argue also murder is gay. Just murder in general is gay. I would argue any assassination is gay. To spend that much time consumed with the life and death of another man, to have that look in your eye. It's the same look in your eye that I see when Ira talks about Charlie Puth. It's a gay look. It's just a gay look.
I think that, you know, but like transforming the killing of Caesar, stealing the Sic Semper Tyrannis, shooting Lincoln in a theater after Lincoln himself had been warned not to come to the theater because his wife was having premonitions, much like the Ides of March warned Caesar that he was going to be murdered. I think that it just took the Caesar murder and made it camp.
Yeah. There are two things here that are very gay. I just want to reiterate. Planning. Planning is like, yeah, you know what I'm saying? We all have the one who, like, gets the Palm Springs trip together. That's what, like, that person is also an assassin, is what I'm arguing.
Well, it's certainly you. I have a feeling it's
you. I'm somebody who's in the passenger side recommending we listen to, like, Helen Reddy music while the planner actually runs the show.
Baby, Lewis is no planner, okay? Let me tell you, Aida, how Lewis throws a birthday party. There was one particular birthday that was at the beach, and all of our friends are heading to the beach, and texts just start coming in. "Hey, could you bring some ice? Hey, could you bring some cups? Hey, does anyone have a speaker? Hey, does anyone have chairs, blankets,
girl? What did
an umbrella?
You bring?
Like, damn." Bring?
He said, did anyone have sand? There's no sand to the beach.
He said, bring your sand to the beach because your beach is better.
You guys, neither of you will understand this, but as an artist, I can't be held to account when it comes to mundane things. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a servant to the spirit and the muse, and therefore you have to bring things like food and ice and ways to occupy yourself for my birthday. Sorry.
There's also limited RAM in your brain, and you've used it all with like the angle of Kate Blanchett's cheekbones. Like, right. You have that memorized. So I understand.
The bandwidth's gone.
Lewis and I are both Leos, but I feel it every fucking day. We have different controlling aspects of Leo-dom. Like, mine manifests in wanting to micromanage the party, but still wanting people to do things for me. His manifests in wanting people to do things for him for the party, but explicitly just asking them to do things.
Right. No, so. and they have to figure out themselves they have to do it. I can't even be aware of the inventory of what's occurring.
Yeah.
I will say, to wrap this up with the Julius Caesar stuff, the gladiator shoe is definitely a gay shoe. That's too much string. Why are you wrapping around the legs so much? Gay.
Right. Mm. It's very, yeah, a lacy shoe. Explain it
so
to me.
So lacy.
Remember when those were coming back?
What do you mean?
It's always like a Charlize Theron or something that just wearing a gladiator shoe.
Yes,
in public.
A Blake Lively and like a romper and a gladiator shoe. I'm with you.
They're just so fucking dramatic for going to brunch, and it's usually white women in Hollywood who do it.
And by the way, I want to shout out the gayness of the show American Gladiators, where. I'm not super concerned with who the men were on that show, but the women were named things like Ice, Gold, Diamond, Siren. Just, they were like superheroes who loved climbing walls and rolling you over in a giant ball. And I think that's like an underrated queer series. Mm.
Anyway, Killing Caesar, kind of gay.
Sure.
But
confirmed.
Taking it to the next level and recreating the killing of Caesar, in my opinion, to kill an American president in a theater is even gayer.
Yeah, ultimate gay. Ultimate gay.
Yeah. HRC recipient, John Wilkes Booth. Yes.
So let's roll the hot take.
Hello, this is Eric calling from London, England, as you can tell from my accent. My queer hot take is that parades are trash. Pride parades are trash. 4th of July parades are trash. Parades celebrating some sport ball team winning are a trash. I hate parades. They're stupid. You basically are standing there watching people walk. Now, parades at Disneyland, maybe the electric parade. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's it. Thanks. Bye.
Eric.
First of all, didn't really hear an English accent there. Don't know what was going on. So a little disappointed.
I don't even know how to respond to you because I don't want to do the accent and make you feel bad, you know? Like, are you aware? Do you know what you sound like?
Me?
I think whenever you do that, you sound like Ainsley Harriet. Truly, I'm brought back to Ainsley Harriet in the late 90s. Yeah.
But about the parades, finally someone said it. Finally someone said what I've been feeling. My last experience with the parade was at Mardi Gras in New Orleans, and I got a fucking cabbage lobbed at me, which is apparently tradition. So, no, fuck parades.
I will say, though, I would be a little bit more supportive of this take if I didn't feel it was subversive Disney propaganda. Like, when a Disney gay is in my midst, first of all, I smell you. I can hear you and your friends already singing along to songs I don't want to hear ever again, and you're, whatever, obsessed with bringing up the gayness of Jafar. We've already relitigated that. I'm done with that. Whatever. Pride parades, at least, there's something about occupying a street where the rowdiness should be, I think, subversive in some way. Irish parades, etc., it's just beer-stained and loud. But putting gayness in the middle of the street, I mean, something is actually accomplished, I feel. So I can't fully dismiss a pride parade.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. Yeah. Parade as protest or parade as celebration feels different than like the very American parade. Something about parades and why I dislike them is they feel so American. And they're very like, John Philip Sousa looking ass type, you know, like Stars and Stripes. Where are we going? Walking from A to B. Like, that's so Oregon Trail. I don't like that. Like, what's the point? Sit your ass down somewhere, bro.
Listen, I always want to raise the roof. I want to carry on before the parade passes by.
All right.
And so that is from Hello Dolly. And that is gay fucking culture. And I will always support a parade.
Who's your favorite Hello Dolly, by the way?
You know, I did see Bette.
Was that an A+?
Yeah, it was an A+. But you know what? I also love Octoroon Carol Channing.
Oh yes. Goodness. My favorite word making an appearance. Thank you. I will say Hello Dolly is definitely gay canon, but I don't think it's lesbian canon, so I'm lost here. I don't have a favorite.
I will say, I think Carol Channing might be the most imitable celebrity of all time. I think she's the number one. Like, everybody can do Yash. You know, that everybody can talk like that.
Girl, come for her. come for her.
She came for herself until she was age 103. So.
And then there's also the 1968, I think, Tony performance from Pearl Bailey.
Yes, of course.
In the all-black production of Hello Dolly. So,
see that one?
Hello, let's celebrate that.
That one might be for me.
Yeah, you know, I like parades, although famously just don't really go to them.
I do have to say, if you've been to five, I can't imagine you're going to get a new and innovative parade experience anytime after that. Like, you know exactly what you're going to get when you go to any kind of parade. They all process at the same speed. I wish we could vary the speeds of parades a little bit more.
Although, I do remember at World Pride last year, the parade being extremely delayed.
That was a parade where people were pouring in from all these different side streets all the time. And so some people were just sitting on random New York avenues for 5 hours at a time before they even started moving, wherever they ended up moving to.
Yes. I think it was our friends Joel Kim Booster and Matt Rogers were stuck on a parade float for Comedy Central that just was not moving.
No. It was right in front of my hotel, and I was like, I think I'm going to take a nap. And I went upstairs, came back, and they were still there.
So sometimes parades do suck.
Sometimes they are trash.
Yeah.
And there's also, again, we've already discussed that planning is a queer activity. If a parade, if a gay parade isn't planned properly, I don't feel like my community is representing itself at it, you know, to the nth.
Yeah. Anyway, enough of that Disney propaganda.
Thank you.
The fuck is the electric parade?
I know.
Do not say those words at me.
No. Well, you know, the electric parade's pretty fun, isn't it?
Oh my God.
why don't we hear another hot take?
Hi, Keep It. This is Izzy, and my lesbian hot take is that the two, like, butler housekeeper people from the Lindsay Lohan Parent Trap, Chessie and Martin, were not in love with each other. They were both gay. To think that Martin at all found women attractive is like a crime against nature. And Chessie lived with, like, Dennis Quaid and didn't think he was attractive, but thought that Martin was attractive. And, like, fell in love with Martin, and, like, I don't know, that seemed like some sort of, like, comp het bullshit. We're like, you know what, we're just gonna, like, make her think she has to fall in love with this ugly British person and, like, get together with him. No, that was stupid. I wholly believe the Parent Trap owes me compensation for taking those two gay people and putting them into a relationship just to tie up those nice loose ends. Like, no, Chessie was a lesbian. Like, that woman screamed dyke energy to me. And Martin was a gay. Like, he's a gay man. Like, that's just what it is. Like, end of story. But they did me dirty. And I think about this once a week, at minimum once a week, since I saw that movie when I was a child. Like, I knew back then. Before I knew I was gay, I knew they were gay. So that is my very, like, impassioned hot take about the Parent Trap characters that probably no one else really cares about, but I care about deeply. Okay, thank you so much.
Okay.
I care about this. I do. I care about this. The crush that I have been harboring for Lisa Ann Walter, who plays Chessie in The Parent Trap, is something I've been quietly living with for a long time. Because, you know, as a black person, to like a white person, I have to come out of the closet. And so I will just keep that quiet to myself. But I will say this. I don't agree with you. On the merit that you said that, God, I feel like I'm debating like in middle school again. When you said,
come on,
that,
Denzel,
come on, LD, come on, Fred,
the great debater.
So you said that Chessie should have liked Dennis Quaid, but she had a working relationship with him. She lived in this man's house. They were friends for a long time. And even though she couldn't tell that the girls had switched, I believe she had a type of clairvoyance because I think she respected the relationship, knowing that Dennis was spoken for. Dennis was going to get back with the woman of his dreams. So I feel like, I don't know. I just don't agree. I don't agree, at least on that side of it.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem crazy to bring up the queerness of this movie and not bring up Elaine Hendricks, who I believe, I think I was put on this earth maybe as a forum for Elaine Hendricks fandom to express itself. Just that kind of like cat-eyed, like sultry smile. Her presence, it's not that she looks exactly like her, but she reminds me of Liz Phair a little bit. There's that kind of like dark, cool, funny energy. And that is what I take from that.
It's like a spunky mouse, you know?
Yes, right, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, clearly, Elaine Hendricks is the queerest part of The Parent Trap because she then stepped into one of the gayest of all iconic roles. She plays Alexis Carrington Colby currently on the reboot of Dynasty. The role originated by Joan Collins. So, you know, hello. That's history. That's history, love.
I was wondering how long we were going to go before Ira mentioned Dynasty again. It'd been a while. It'd been a long time.
Thank you.
I think it's an appropriate amount of time, though. An appropriate amount of time. And also, in that movie, it's been a long time since I've seen The Parent Trap. Pardon me. But doesn't she threaten to send those Lindsay Lohan to Switzerland?
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm talking about. When I signed up to be gay, I wanted evil. I wanted controlling the futures of helpless underlings.
That's what was in the pamphlet.
Yes.
Yes, right. Yes. Mm-hmm. All types of hats. That's what was in the pamphlet. So I just want follow through.
Yes. Well, Ira, what do you think of this?
Yeah. What a wonderful childhood we had growing up with her and Joan in Addams Family Values.
Mm. Mm, yes, quite.
You know?
And also, by the way,
women who hate children.
And also, by the way, Elaine Hendricks in Superstar, not a good movie, but her role, very funny, where she plays somebody named Evian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's Molly Shannon movie. Screams at her, hey, Evian, go drink a bottle of yourself.
That character's named that just for that joke.
Right, exactly. Yeah. No, even as a child, I was like, is this just lazy? Like, they didn't have to name her that, but it's for that joke.
I truly disagree with the take as well. I get what Aida said about the working relationship. I mean, Dennis Quaid is hot. We all know this, okay? She acknowledged it as well, you know? But you don't cross that boundary, you know? This isn't Sabrina.
Speaking my language, yeah. By the way, can we again talk about Humphrey Bogart and his quote-unquote sexual pull of an audience? The man was a pretty camel. He was a camel.
A pretty camel.
What would Audrey ever see in him?
No, and Audrey, who's like the most geometrically perfect, not just human, organism who has ever lived, being into him, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, it makes so much more sense in the remake when the Humphrey Bogart role is played by Harrison Ford.
Quite, yes.
An actual hot man.
Yeah, with some sexuality about him as opposed to just cigarettes.
Yeah, he's always like, here's a looking at you, kid. You know, I'm always like, no one wants to be looking at you, Humphrey Bogart. I know it's looking at me. No one's looking at you.
Ingrid Bergman's like, I'm fine. I don't know about you,
though. Please, 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 let's look at me. besides, the true relationship that this caller is talking about from The Parent Trap, the real gay version of that is Cece and Niles in The Nanny.
Oh.
Oh, that is exactly what I was going to... When I first, you know, heard this, I was like, no. CeCe and Niles, for sure. They were gay. This is not true. I will say, though, Chessie, I don't think is gay, but Martin, gay. Gay on his own. Singularly gay, but gay.
But famously, just, you know, like, as much as I enjoy Nancy Myers, you know, as a strong woman.
Right.
And makes a lot of films that also center women's sexuality and women in business. Not a lot of queer content.
No.
To be honest. I don't watch Nancy Myers films and go, hey, that's speaking to me as a gay person.
The closest is she wrote the movie and got Oscar nominated for Private Benjamin, in which Eileen Brennan plays like the drill sergeant woman who like makes Goldie Hawn's life hell. And then there's a lesbian reveal with her. That is actually pretty strange for the Nancy Myers filmography, though, because I don't expect that type of thing from her.
Right. The thing you expect from Nancy is just like really being horny for kitchens.
Right, no. a skillet set, yeah. I'm talking about copper. Yeah.
Yes, an island that you just want to lay across and bake cookies.
Yes. Picture Michelle Pfeiffer in The Fabulous Baker Boys, but on a kitchen island. That is the ideal Nancy Myers experience.
Yes, she's baking, and she's baking the boys.
That's too much. So,
that was dumb.
No.
That was dumb. I'm
Good
sorry,
try.
Michelle Pfeiffer. I'm sorry. Anyway, what I think about this hot take is Nancy Meyer. Love her, but not a queer icon.
True.
Sorry. I like this. We should keep doing hot takes.
Yes, I agree. People out there are spicy, and it deserves to be heard. And also made fun of. I think we do a good job of that.
Coming up next, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. As always, it's Keep It.
How are you guys doing this week?
You know,
I would say I'm in a better place than I usually am in a pandemic. I say usually am because it's been now, what, 7 or 8 years?
Yeah.
But always when we get to the point of the show where we do Keep It, I have to warm up for it. I have to gather the strength to get through the rancor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well... Get your shoes, baby. Get your shoes, baby. Aida, you can go first.
Okay, well, this week my Keep It goes to Tina Fey, or in black circles, I like to call her Tina O'Fay. Wow. Where do I begin? Where do I begin?
I just got it.
Good. Yeah. So in the wake of the nation deciding to give a fuck about black people, the people over at 30 Rock are deciding to finally pull the episodes of the show that feature blackface. Is there one? No. Is there two? No. Is there three? No. There's 4 fucking episodes that feature blackface. So Tina, Miss O'Fay. Look, girl, nobody cares about your late decision to fix what you did like 10 years ago, which you are a grown woman. You are 50 years old now. You wrote those episodes with your team in your big age of 40. You knew what you were doing. Like, I just don't understand how I'm supposed to feel, especially in the memo, which is Tina Fey's request to NBC and other streaming services to pull the episodes. They have the nerve to call it race-changing makeup. Bitch, what the fuck? Where do you guys pull these concepts? How about when you're talking about our issues, you call it what we call it, which is blackface, which is what you did. And the frustrating thing is now I'm here screaming about blackface, which I can't even really be mad about anymore because it's at every single corner. I'm more mad about the virtue signaling that the white people and white creators are doing, and they're suddenly deciding that they want to repent for their ignorance because we're just like stepping on their necks about it. You just open your purse, Tina. Don't apologize. I don't care what you did. You already did it. You've been profiting off of, you know, punching down on Native Americans, women, black people for your entire career. Like, you're not going to fix that now. Just pay us. Just pay. Donate to a black mutual fund. Do something. Help black creators. You did this most recently again on Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, where you cast white people to play Native Americans and used race-changing makeup. And at that time, back in 2015, you didn't apologize for it. You said, I no longer am apologizing for my jokes. So I just don't know what's changed. And I want to see more from you. I'm not going to tell you not to do it, not to pull the episodes, pull them. But that's the very least you can do. And yeah, give me money to write a show, Tina Fey. That's it. That's what you can do.
What I'll point out about the Tina Fey thing, too, is it's sort of a lot like the Sarah Silverman thing in that there was a particular time in comedy where white liberals were using things like blackface or other racial jokes as a way to comment on racism being bad. But there's the question of if you are using racist epithets and also, you know, racist caricatures or racist imagery to comment on racism, are you then creating racist imagery yourself?
A central part of this kind of joking is the idea that the white creator is saying, I understand racism, so this can't be racist. You know, yeah. And it's like, why would a person of color care whether or not you think you're racist? Like, you're centering your own self-belief in a way that I think is probably just annoying. You know, probably just, like, are you really, like, writing this material thinking, oh, I hope a person of color sees it? Probably not, right?
That's the thing about it, too. It's, you know, this is right after, like, Spike Lee's Bamboozle, too, you know? It's like, we have black people already who've addressed blackface and why it's hurtful. And here you have white people doing comedy to make a commentary on this. And it's like, no one is watching 30 Rock looking for Tina Fey to denounce blackface, you know? It's this weird sort of thing that I would say that white liberal comedians have where they want to comment on something and it's, you know what? Hire some black people to comment on it, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I would look at blackface jokes from a black sitcom and a black creator, but also a black creator probably doesn't want to deal with that shit, you know? It's this curiosity in stuff. You sort of like with gay jokes or other things too, where, you know, like straight people, cis people, white people, like they love to, in their comedy, have these sort of boundary-pushing jokes. And the question becomes, who are you pushing the boundary for? You know, you're pushing it to entertain other white people. It's not for your audience.
And it's also, again, self-congratulatory. It reminds me a little bit of, like, if I post something about whatever, coming out, Pride Month, whatever, on my Facebook or whatever, inevitably somebody whom I don't know will comment with, wait, you're gay? And it's like this moment where they're indicating to me that they get it, that they are cool, but it's meanwhile also contrived. It's also wanting my congratulations that they're liberal enough to be cool with gayness. And it's like, you just wasted my time with some bullshit. And yeah. And yet I'm supposed to congratulate you for it.
People often do that with me too. They go, well, you're black when they post photos. Yeah. It's strange. It's strange.
I'm gonna actually use this to segue into mine because it's the same conversation. Because it's reminding me of the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, where Tina Fey came under fire for a episode where Titus is, you know, playing like a geisha, and it's a very racist episode towards Asian Americans.
All that powder on his face. Yes.
Right. And that was another thing where it was supposed to be commenting on how racist it is, but it actually just ended up being racist. And I remember Tina Fey defending it at the time and being mad at people for being mad at her online and sort of just talking about how, like, that's why I'm not on social media. You know, like, people are always upset about these things, as if we should be thanking her for being anti-racist enough to caricature Asians on her Netflix series, right? And this brings me into my Keep It, which involves the responses to racist shit like this. We all know that one of my friends and former coworkers, Megan Amram, came under fire this week for explicitly anti-Asian tweets. Jokes making of Chinese people, making fun of Asian people in general, their ableist tweets. A lot of them are just like really sort of horrendous and not funny. And there's the question of whether or not you believe her apology or not. Like, some people think that she should have gone further in her apology and explicitly acknowledged what she did wrong. I'm not here to address that, though. What I want to address is this weird need from people to expect people of color to comment on what white people are doing, you know? So I think a lot about the Toni Morrison quote where she said, you know, the function, the very serious function of racism is distraction. It keeps you from doing your work, you know? Leave me out of it. Leave me out of it. Because in the sense of this Megan Amram stuff, our friend Bowen, who was just on the show, had to come out with a statement about Megan's tweets, right? And his first tweet is, "Hello, I've been asked by lots of people to talk about the Megan Amram tweets, which, in addition to being ableist and anti-Semitic, were explicitly anti-Asian thematically even." And he goes into why they are racist and about how it's sort of the basis humor, etc. But I want to talk about why Bowen Yang, who did not hire Megan Amram, who does not work with her currently in any capacity, who people are tweeting at him and also Matt Rogers because she was recently on Las Culturistas, their podcast, why it's his fucking job to do a tweet thread about why Megan Amram's tweets are racist just to make you feel better. I find it so dumb the way that we constantly, when someone does racist shit like this, the way we exhaust other people of color to make a statement about it, you know? And I get that we should be denouncing racism wherever we can, you know? And I get that, like, we have shit like the fucking president making, like, kung flu jokes about COVID-19. And so there is a lot of rampant anti-Asian racism that is just sort of, like, allowed in the common dialogue right now that we should take a stand against. But I also just find something, like, exhausting and sinister about people tagging Bowen and being like, what do you have to say about this? You know, about people tagging William Jackson Harper from The Good Place, being like, what do you think about this? She was a writer on your show, etc. You know, and like there was a comment from some woman that was just like, truly it's getting weird.
Uh-huh.
Of comments. this woman responded to him, "I just want to thank you on Juneteenth. Where, you know, like, we are all thinking of better ways that we can be an ally to Black people, and you took time out of your day to be an ally to me as an Asian woman." And I was like, girl, shut the fuck up. That is so weird.
Boo.
That is so weird.
Juneteenth, the holiday weird. Where we think of other people. Yeah.
Right. You bringing up Juneteenth to thank this Black man for making a comment about Megan Amram's racist tweets about Asian people. And yes, we are all in this together. And I'm glad that he made a statement about it because the tweets are horrendous. But also, it is Juneteenth. And also, this Black man has been dealing with the horrendous shit that has been happening to Black people in this country for centuries, and especially being highlighted in the past couple weeks. If he didn't want to take the fucking time to write about some tweets from someone who wrote jokes for him on a TV show that is not even on the air anymore, he didn't fucking have to.
And also, this is what makes me, this is the evil, insidious, cyclical part of this, is that Bowen keeps making headlines when other people do racist shit to him. We yes. remember when he got cast on SNL, when mm-hmm. Shane Gillis and Chloe Fineman and he got cast on SNL, and Shane Gillis got removed from the show because of the racist anti-Asian comments that he'd made, and everyone was like, oh, how does Bowen feel? How does Bowen feel? And Bowen was trending all over Twitter, and Bowen should be trending because he's fucking talented. He's amazing, and he's an amazing creator and an amazing comedian, and it just this keeps up fucking happening to him, and it's so frustrating. Lauren didn't say anything. Why should Bowen have to say anything?
Right. And also the Bowen thing of there was a joke of Kat Cohen being canceled recently too, like an
Boo
old
that
video
bitch.
That she, an old
Boo
video
that
she
bitch.
Made where she put a noose like around a Black person's neck in some sort of joke. I want to know who the Black person was in this video, by the way, because he should have known better too. But people were tagging Bowen and Matt being like, make a comment about Kat Cohen, make a comment about Kat Cohen. Why do they need to make a fucking comment? Because they know him, you know? People were rudely tagging Andrew Law being like, another friend of ours being like, oh, you are working with Megan on The Good Place. Where's your comment? because he's Asian, he needs to comment. I want to also point out that we need to talk about power structures in Hollywood, and everyone just maybe thinks that it's a free-for-all where we all have the same sort of power, but it's like, I just worked on a sitcom, an animated sitcom, Q-Force, with Megan, that she was a co-producer on, you know? And I am a writer on it, you know? I am a story editor on that. I am several rungs below her.
Yeah.
So the only reason people weren't tagging me, being like, what's your comment on it? Because the show's not out and they don't know about us working together, right?
They don't know.
But people probably would, and that's a thing where it's like, she is so many rungs above me that my comment on it is like, it's not like I hired her. It's not like I could fire her, you know? It's they're people of color trying to make it in Hollywood, working for Megan's, working for the Tina Fey's, you know, right. Like, I wouldn't expect a black person who was in 30 Rock to be commenting on these blackface episodes.
And they shouldn't have to put themselves in the line of fire.
Because we are working and getting checks so that we can hopefully go and create our own content and don't have to work for white people who think it's funny making racist jokes.
So fucking frustrating.
Also, on the occasion that somebody like that does respond to something like this, like, seriously check their Twitter mentions. And if you're like a white person, would you want to deal with some of these fucking people? I mean, it's just...
No.
What you open yourself up to clearly is like so time consuming and so potentially grisly, you know?
Yeah. It's always like, thank you. Thank you for doing this. And I'm like, you are exhausting me.
But then also like weird naysayers too. Yeah. You know what I mean?
You know, I was weirdly reminded though that I was in an episode of an Emmy for Megan, her web series.
Of course you were.
and the episode was about diversity, right? And one of the jokes is she did a 23andMe and finding out she was a 1% Korean, and maybe she should pretend to be Korean for the diversity. And to be fair, that joke was funny because there were jokes that I ad-libbed that she should pull an Emma Stone.
Yes, well, as long as you brought it back to the other fuckery white woman are doing,
I was
I'm
like,
with you.
You should pull an Emma Stone. If people ask you about it, tell them it was Lena Dunham's idea, not mine. Yeah. Surprised no one clipped that out and dragged me. Anyway, that is just to say my keep it is, this is exhausting. Stop it.
And boo Kat Cohen. I just want to add that in there. So
I fine. Have not seen that video, by the way. Not that
I'll send it. I'll send it to you, Lewis.
Okay.
It's a mess. Yeah.
And Lewis, what's your keep it? Sorry.
This is a fearful keep it. Okay. It's out of appreciation. But my keep it is to these goddamn K-pop teens and TikTok tweens who, as we know, trolled Trump to a legendary extent and filled his Tulsa stadium for his rally with nobody. And I want to say that that's a wonderful feat and a clever feat. But again, I am now 33 years old. I am already afraid enough of mortality. I cannot be afraid of the power of people half my age. I'm sorry. You have now become time consuming to me. You are smarter than I am. I think you can ruin my life in ways that I won't understand until 15 years from now. I think you're aware of technology that literally the Apple store isn't familiar with yet. So I'm just saying, when you are great and when you are successfully trolling Donald Trump in ways that, by the way, like, every comedian is trying to do and failing, like actually getting under his skin, actually like ruining the reign of terror in a certain way for him. Know that I'm afraid of you and that I can only appreciate you as I tremble in your shadow.
That's fair.
I'm a K-pop fan and I'm afraid of other K-pop fans because first of all, every group has like 70 fucking members in it. And
right.
I barely know like two members' names and I remember all of them.
Yeah.
Right. I will say that I love the activism from K-pop stans just because as a K-pop fan, K-pop unfortunately does have a history of anti-blackness.
Yeah.
You know, like a lot of, you know, like wearing black, like, hairstyles and, you know, like there's some black, I think it was Mamamoo was a K-pop group that like did like a Uptown Funk parody and like there was like some blackface involved. So like this is shit like, you know, this weird sort of like anti-blackness pervades racism everywhere, right? And it's not, and Asian culture, Korean culture isn't immune to it. And a lot of K-pop in the past has sort of done shit like that. So I'm glad that there's sort of this reckoning of K-pop fans coming out for Black Lives Matter and just sort of making amends because I love K-pop. And, you know, like, people should listen to Blackpink and Red Velvet and Twice and Sistar and Chungha. And Sunmi.
Sour Candy is rising and my favorite Chromatica tracks. I will say Sour Candy is rising and my favorite Chromatica tracks.
That's fair.
And Blackpink has a new song out Friday. So stream that shit. Anyway, that's our show. Thank you to Sam Lansky for joining us. And we'll see you next week. This has been Keep It. Keep It is a product of Crooked Media. Caroline Rustin is our producer. It's Caroline, like the princess, the one you don't care about. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seguin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Nadine Melkonian, for filming and editing our video content every week.
I'm Roman Mars, host of 99% Invisible. I love the book, The Power Broker, the epic biography of former New York City planner Robert Moses. So I'm breaking it down 100 pages at a time and talking to special guests about why this book matters, like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I actually think if it wasn't for Robert Moses, I probably wouldn't have run for Congress.
Listen to 99% Invisible's breakdown of The Power Broker every month on the 99% Invisible podcast feed.